listeners, I hope you're ready for the final part of the special Conspiracy Month bonus show. I love you.
Robert Mayer's witty and riveting novel, IJFK, in which the young president dictates from heaven his memories of the days of Camelot, performed by Bruce Watson and Paula Strongheart Garfield.
The last day of my life, I rose early. I was scheduled to address a crowd in the parking lot across from the hotel before Jackie and I attended a Chamber of Commerce breakfast. I was in a good mood while shaving. The crowd so far had been large and enthusiastic, in part, no doubt, because of Jackie's rare presence. And Jackie seemed to be enjoying herself, or at least giving a good imitation of it. I spoke to the crowd across from the Texas Hotel, then went to the ballroom. Jackie was 20 minutes late for the breakfast. I use my standard line for such occasions. Mrs. Kennedy is organizing herself. It does take longer, but of course she looks better than we do when she does it. When she did enter, the breakfasters stood and craned their necks to get a glimpse of her. Why is it, I asked, that nobody wonders what Lyndon and I will be wearing? What she was wearing, of course, was what I had picked out in Washington, the pink. After the chamber speech, we returned to the suite to relax for an hour before making the short plane trip to Dallas. We could have driven there, but airport crowds are always good copy. While waiting, I placed a call to Uvalde, Texas, where John Nance Garner, Roosevelt's first vice president, was marking his 95th birthday. I saw a glimpse of myself in the future, wheelchair-ridden or bedridden, drooling tubes coming out of every orifice. I did not, I decided, ever want to be 95. As we prepared to leave, Roy Kellerman, the head of the Secret Service detail, entered the room. He said the Dallas papers had predicted rain, but that the weather there seemed to be brightening. His men there wanted to know if I wanted the bubble top for the limousine on or off. I knew that Jackie liked it on, so the wind wouldn't muss her hair. But this was a political trip. We had come here specifically to be seen. And so, of course, I made a political decision. If it's not raining, I said, I'll have the bubble off. You'll recall, we were in the midst of recounting the death of Marilyn Monroe when the previous chapter came to an end. It was Bobby, of course, who came walking up the gravel path just as the two Neanderthals dressed up like Jackie and Ethel burst out the door and disappeared. Bobby. Dear Bobby. My Lancelot. All Bobby knew, of course, was that Marilyn was dead. Perhaps murdered. He'd seen her corpse. By the next afternoon, it was all over radio and television, on the front page of the newspapers. The nation would not be shocked that much by a death until more than a year later, until my own. An overdose of pills, perhaps accidental, the report said, though there were implications that it might have been suicide. Bobby was deeply depressed. I was in a rage. Every such clandestine action provokes an equal and opposite reaction. My reaction was to move once more against Castro. I ordered full speed ahead on Operation Mongoose with Bobby in charge. It would take his mind off Marilyn. It would channel my bitterness. It would divert the agencies to political, not personal mischief. If my golden muse was gone, I would give vent to the darker side. The CIA again began working with Rosselli and Momo to get the bastard assassinated. A huge covert operation was established in Miami and New Orleans to devise plans to undermine the Cuban regime. I made no inquiry into which CIA was handling it. I didn't care, as long as someone got the job done. We let the Cuban refugees know that they would get another crack at the invasion. We built up the naval force in the Caribbean. In charge of it all, I put Bobby. By day, he worked at Justice, intensifying his war on the mob. That year, he would put 288 mobsters on trial. The year I took office, only 35 had been indicted. By night, he worked on Mongoose, checking plans, reading reports, firing up the special group, our own little Death for Castro committee. And somewhere in there, I think it was between 3 a.m. and 3:05, he would even turn his attention to civil rights. While all this was going on, Castro, coward that he was, got the notion that he ought to defend himself. He turned for help to his Uncle Samovar in the Kremlin, Khrushchev responded with generosity. He gave Castro an autumn solstice gift of 20,000 Russian troops, 150 jet fighters, 350 tanks, 1,300 pieces of field artillery, and 700 anti-aircraft guns. Not to mention a series of huge crates being unloaded in Havana Harbor that could have been pear trees, but probably weren't. Our war against him was a great secret to the American people. Bobby and I felt it was a gauche of him to go public in such a material way. Then the trouble started. Senator Keating of New York, being fed secret information by one CIA or the other, announced that the Russians were putting missiles in Cuba. Bobby talked to the Russian ambassador. He was assured that only defensive missiles were being placed there. It was hard to explain to the American people why Castro should need defensive weapons, since we surely meant him no harm. So we painted him as a paranoid. And I made a ringing speech declaring that we will not tolerate offensive weapons in Cuba. A few weeks later, we sent a U-2 spy plane to snap some pictures over the island. Among them was one shot that appeared to show construction sites for offensive surface-to-surface missiles. The photos were pretty small, but with the aid of a magnifying glass, the missile sites were pretty clear. And off across the ocean, headed toward Cuba, was a fleet of Russian freighters with large tarpaulin-covered cylinders on their decks. These were either huge baseball bats, well, we did know that Castro liked baseball, or medium-sized dildos, or offensive missiles. Since the Russians had said they wouldn't send missiles, I subscribed to the dildo theory myself, but we had to act on the assumption that they were missiles just in case. What follows is well known, the 13 tense days that have come to be known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. The special group was split down the middle. Half wanted me to send in the Air Force to knock out the missile sites. The other half favored a blockade to prevent the missiles from arriving. I opted for the blockade and told Khrushchev we would board his ships if they approached Cuba and turn back any that carried missiles. Any that refused to be boarded, we would sink. I went on national television to explain to the people what was happening. If we sank a Russian ship, Khrushchev would have to retaliate, and the result might be nuclear war. But this risk, however grave, we had to take, I said. We could not allow Soviet offensive missiles in Cuba, only 180 miles from my father's compound at Palm Beach. The only thing I inadvertently omitted from my speech was the fact that we had been making covert war on Cuba for many months, that we had therefore precipitated the crisis ourselves, and that it was all a result of the death of Marilyn Monroe. Khrushchev fumed and blustered in public about the right to defend his allies, but in private he was scared shitless. He didn't want a nuclear war any more than I did. When the radar screens showed that the Soviet ships were indeed turning around, we in the White House rejoiced. It was my finest hour as president. I couldn't help thinking of Lincoln. "This is the night I should go to the theater," I told Bobby. Bobby laughed, but his response was strangely prophetic. "If you go, I want to go with you." The air is imploding around us, imploding with a suffusion of light. Something is changing, moving. It is Lyndon and I who are changing, moving. The others seem to be receding from us. We are drifting, drifting. We drift past all of them into a realm of clouds, purple clouds and black and gray, till we tumble to the cloud of lead. There is, at first, the tail end of a storm. We huddle together, Lyndon and I, alone in a windy vastness, rather like Lear and his fool, though which of us be king and which be jester I cannot say. We dare not speak, lest we cry out in childish fear. Then the wind departs. A veil of vapor rises, and they are there, beside us, the maimed and the naked and the dead. We are not alone in a wasteland, as it had seemed. They are beside us. They are with us, as they have always been with us. We want to turn. We want to run. Our legs are leaden as the cloud. It seems for a moment as if we are rooted, as if in single file, one line on each side, they will move toward us. They will file past us to reveal their wounds and to revile. But this does not happen. Somehow we know, we understand without words, that it is we who must move toward them. We take one heavy step, then another. Slowly, we move among them on leaden legs. The terror of not knowing what is expected is humbling. I fear that they will reach out to us like beggars. They don't. Instead, they hide their faces. They turn away. I expect them to flaunt their wounds, to press their festering pus to our eyes. But the opposite occurs. They hide their wounds from us as best they can. It is as if they, not we, are ashamed. In time, we come upon a clearing. A small group has gathered together, leaving a space. Something is happening in this group. We cross the space. We stand behind the last of them. Above their heads, we see an image, something like an altar of light. As we watch from afar, one among them mounts a cloud of stairs. It is a young woman, dressed in white, dressed in vapors, dressed in veils. She turns from the altar to face the others. I think I recognize her then. I think it is Kim. The naked girl in the photograph, the one who came and bid us to make our visit. We stand silent. We watch. One by one, her friends move closer. Each in turn embraces her. I want to move forward, to embrace her myself. But my motive might be suspect. Then, the last embrace concludes. We grow tense. We prepare to watch the actual ascent. But already, the gathering is breaking up. The others are returning to their places. Only the girl is missing. Only she has vanished. We turn to resume our journey. Lyndon appears downcast. I feel myself awed, transfixed. I have just seen a miracle. Again, we move among the naked, among the dead. From the left, a figure approaches us, greets us. She is the first one to do so, the first to speak to us.
I'm glad you came. I'm glad you made your visit.
I am puzzled. She looks familiar. You are...
Kim. Don't you remember?
Yes, of course, I say. How could I forget? But just now, over there, you ascended. We saw it ourselves.
Not me. I hope to someday, of course. But not today.
But we saw you, I say. Kim only smiles and shakes her head.
Please come again.
She turns and walks away. We watch her go. In an instant, we are back where we had been. Bobby, Adlai, and the Reverend are chatting. They do not seem to know that we've been gone. They are discussing Marilyn again. She has become the mascot, if not the patron saint of our crowd. I don't know what happened in there, Bobby is insisting. I know, of course, but have never said. It's a secret I took to the grave and beyond. I never told Bobby. He's the last one I wanted to know, and yet now, with my time here running out, perhaps I think it is time to speak.
I know what happened, Hoover says.
He's horned into the group again, and he says it proudly, almost boastfully.
I'll bet you do, Bobby says, bitterness still dripping in his voice.
Tell them!
It is a booming command from a passing white cloud. J. Edgar blanches at the sound, the first time he's lost his rosy cheeks.
We had to do it. Me and my friend, we had to kill her. It was a matter of national security.
You,
Bobby says.
She was a sick lady, Hoover defends himself. Frustrated, confused, she was having an affair with the president, whom she was growing tired of, and she was in love with the attorney general. We obtained information that she was about to go public with this, We made a determination that that could not be allowed to happen. It would have disgraced the president.
So you killed her for my sake? I asked dryly.
No, sir,
Hoover protests.
Not at all, but like it or not, you were the president. Your disgrace would have been the nation's disgrace. It would have weakened our alliances overseas. It might have led to civil discontent at home. It was in the interest of the United States of America that Miss Monroe be silenced before she dragged your name through the...
Seaman?
Precisely.
What did you do, precisely?
Bobby asks. He is controlling a rage that Hoover does not even notice. They are discussing the murder of a woman Bobby loved.
Precisely!
J. Edgar explodes.
Why, we had a couple of masks struck at the lab. Masks of Jackie and Ethel. A little private joke there. And and my friend and I put on a few old things, you know, we had in the closet. And, well, we went out there and killed her. Just forced some pills down her throat and made it look like suicide. Simple thing, dearie.
Now, I say gently, why don't you tell them the real reason, J. Edgar? Hoover blanches again.
The real reason?
Tell them,
booms the passing white cloud. Hoover stutters again. He seems incapable of speech. Very well, I'll tell them, I offer. It's true, Hoover was afraid that Marilyn would go public. She never would have, of course. It was just his own paranoia. But if she did, in his view, it would be his ass in a sling. If the affair became known, mine and Marilyn's, then Hoover's precious secret tapes would be worthless. It would be a front-page scandal. Me and Marilyn, adultery in the White House, Princess Jackie is the wronged woman, betrayal of the public trust. If that had happened, who would have cared about his 20-year-old tapes of me and Inga, or any of the others from my bachelor days? Nobody. Nothing could outdo the president and the sex queen. Hoover would have had no more power to blackmail me. He knew I would know it, and he knew that the first thing that I would do would be to boot his ass out, end his career. So he decided to terminate Marilyn first. But my time is growing short. I must select what to discuss. I don't have time to bore you to tears. I no longer aspire to a Pulitzer for this modest volume. My sexual escapades will have turned the judges red. We emerged from the plane in Dallas into the glaring bright spotlight of the sun. All that followed would be etched forever with the shadows of high noon. Love Field, they called it, one of the lesser ironies of the day. The crowd at the airport was enthusiastic. As always, airport crowds are hired by Central Casting. We climbed into the presidential limousine, the bubble top down. Me on the right, Jackie on the left. The John Connolly's on the jump seat in front of us. One of the theories that emerged after the assassination was that the principal target had been Connolly, who, as Secretary of the Navy, had denied Oswald an honorable discharge. What is it the kids say today? Get real. The motorcade crossed the airport, moved out onto the highway. Crowds lined both sides, waving, cheering. Son of a bitch, I thought. Dallas loves us. How many had been paid off to be there, I wondered later, to throw the Secret Service off guard. So now we are here. The moment you have been waiting for. The shots. Was it three or four? The screams, the puffs of smoke, the pieces of flesh and brain spattering through the air. You've all seen the Zapruder film. Some of you can hardly wait. Alas, I'm afraid you must. In order to make sense of what happened, we must trace the many forces of evil that converged on Dallas that day, and to do that, we must go back briefly in time. Do not worry, we'll get to the blood and gore soon enough. The date was October 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday, the day the stock market crashed. On such a momentous day, a little note was taken of a child born prematurely in a small lying-in hospital in Beverly Hills, California. The child, a boy, was born to a pretty but unknown actress named Ginny King. On the birth certificate, the child's father was listed as unknown. The mother, in her modest but comfortable room with all the bills prepaid, looked down at her infant son, smaller even than most newborns, and named him Arthur. Ginny King was happy, eager to love and raise her baby. She would not lack for money. The child's father had assured her of that. As long as she did not bother him. He was a family man, and he did not want trouble. 2 years later, her maternal affection turned to bitterness. The child wasn't growing very well. At first, his small size had been attributed to his premature birth. Now, the doctors informed the young actress that her son was a midget, that he would never reach a height of 4 feet. I shall omit the gross depravity of the child's life. Suffice it to say that he grew up in an orphanage, unwanted and unloved. He became bitter and hateful and desperate for revenge. But revenge against whom? As a teenager, Arthur King ran away from the orphanage. In many of the places he went, sharp-eyed strangers took note of the free-spending American who harbored so many resentments, who had no purpose in life. They went to their superiors, and they discussed an idea. What if we gave this American midget a purpose in life? Something to live for. Something, perhaps, to die for. I don't have time for the details of the recruitment. Take my word for it, it was done, and done, and done yet again. By whom? Adley asks me. By everyone. As the motorcade inched its way toward Dealey Plaza, Carlos Marcello was in a courtroom in New Orleans standing trial for extortion. The charges had been brought by the U.S. Justice Department, by my brother Bobby. The jury was out, but Marcello wasn't worried. Marcello looked at his watch. It was 12:28. He turned to a youthful associate.
"Hey, how come no news yet?"
he asked.
"In a minute now," the associate said. "Don't worry, Lee's a good shot. Lee won't miss."
"You want to get an alligator's tail?"
Marcello said.
"You don't bite off his tail, you bite off his head. Then the tail will die."
"I don't get it."
"Nothing to get," Marcello said. "Just some monkey talk."
They were interrupted by the return of the jury. The jury found Carlos Marcello not guilty. Carlos Marcello smiled. It would be a good day all around. At the same time in Havana, Fidel Castro was sitting down to lunch with his good friend Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He seemed anxious. Garcia Marquez asked him why.
"I am expecting some news from America,"
Castro said.
"Good news?"
Garcia Marquez asked.
"I hope. The death of a dictator."
In Detroit, Jimmy Hoffa was in a barbershop getting a shave. He screeched when the barber nicked his neck.
"Hey, don't be so touchy, Jimmy,"
the barber said.
"Albert Anastasia got worse."
"Yeah, very funny," Hoffa said. "You got a big mouth."
"It's your own fault," the barber said. "You're squirming around like you got ants in your jock, huh? You want a shave? Sit still."
Hoffa grabbed the towel from around his neck, began to wipe off the shaving cream.
"Turn on the TV,"
he barked.
"I'm expecting a bulletin."
In Russia, it was already night, but the lights were burning late in the Kremlin. In his private office, Chairman Khrushchev unlaced his shoes and spoke to his UN ambassador, Andrei Gromyko.
"Any news?"
"Not yet," Gromyko said.
"Not to worry,"
the chairman said, as if to reassure himself.
"The midgets won't miss."
"Castro's midget?"
"He's not Castro's midget. He's my midget. Castro thinks he's his midget. He thinks he turned the CIA's midget. He thinks he made him a double midget. But we recruited him the first time he came to Russia. He's been my midget all along."
Lee Harvey Oswald was nervous. Up till now, everything had been going perfectly. He had gotten the job at the book depository. Weeks later, just a few days ago, it had been announced that this would be the route, just as they had assured him it would. For weeks, he had been practicing with the $12.78 mail-order rifle. It worked just fine. He had taken it from the garage that morning and smuggled it into the building. No one had noticed. When he'd seen the motorcade on the highway about a half a mile away, he had quietly opened the window and crouched beside it. Only now, for the first time, he was nervous. What if he missed?
"If you get him,"
the guy had said,
"they'll take care of you for life. But if you miss, they'll kill you."
Lee Harvey Oswald had been very happy to distribute leaflets on behalf of Fidel Castro. But die for him? His hands began to shake. Jack Ruby was also nervous. He crouched behind a bush on the grassy knoll beside Dealey Plaza. The crowds were beginning to cheer. The motorcade must be coming into view, and no midget. He should have been here minutes ago. He'd been on the phone for weeks with the boys in Chicago, the boys in New Orleans, the boys in Miami. He was sure he'd gotten it straight. The assassin would be a midget. He'd be crouching behind the white fence on the grassy knoll with a high-powered rifle with a telescopic sight. He wouldn't miss. The president's head would explode. The crowd would scream in horror. The whole scene would turn to chaos. The midget would drop his rifle into a bush and calmly walk away from the scene, expecting to disappear into the crowd. But they couldn't let that happen. The midget knew too much. As soon as the midget threw away his rifle, he, Jack Ruby, was to step from behind a bush and shoot the midget with his pistol. Except, there was this last-minute hitch. Where the fuck was the midget? The midget was nowhere in sight. Jack Ruby pondered what to do. Usually he did not have to think. They told him what to do, and he obeyed. Thinking wasn't one of his assets. But now he thought fast. What would they want of him? The answer was obvious. They wanted Kennedy dead. If the midget had chickened out, then he, Jack Ruby, would have to take his place. From the pocket of his jacket, he removed his snub-nosed pistol. He gripped it tight.
Where the hell is the midget?
Lyndon chimes in.
This Arthur King.
Don't, Bobby says. Don't tell him who Arthur King was. That's something you mustn't tell anyone, Jack. I'm sorry, Bobby. It's like I said before. Something has overtaken me, has entered me, as my hour approaches. It's as if I'm no longer capable of deceit. You can just stop talking, Bobby says.
Jack!
It's Lyndon. He's beginning to see the light.
Don't tell me. Don't tell me you're hinting at what I think you're hinting at. Nobody in the world would believe that.
Like Lyndon, you too may have guessed, dear listener. When my father was playing movie mogul in Hollywood in the 1920s, he was not faithful to Gloria Swanson any more than he was faithful to my mother. He was willing to give the business to any impressionable starlet in sight. So it was with Ginny King. Only Ginny gave him the business back by getting large with child. Pop cared little for the feelings of wife or mistress, but even then he was looking down the long road toward the presidency. So, when Ginny refused to abort, he endowed her with sufficient funds to ensure her silence forever. Meticulous in all things, he made Ginny sign a blood oath that the child was his, a paper he secreted away against such time as it might be useful to him should the child prove in some way worthy. This paper the FBI stumbled upon during its investigation of my father prior to his government service. It was this paper, in addition to their shared bigotries, that kept Pop and Hoover buddies for so long. If Rosemary was the skeleton in the family closet, then Arthur was the festering petri dish. Arthur grew up ignorant of his paternity until mid-November of 1963. By that time, he was 34 years old, 3 feet 8 inches tall, and in the secret employ, as we have seen, of the Cubans, the CIA, the anti-Castro right wing, the Russians, the FBI, and the mob. Fate had conspired to have all six of these self-serving entities plotting my death simultaneously, and had chosen Arthur King, my own brother, as the rifle-wielding instrument of murder. Half-brother, Bobby corrects in torment. If Arthur King was having second thoughts about killing the president for money, or for political purposes, Hoover reasoned, he just might do it out of envy. Arthur was short and I was tall. Arthur was hateful and I was charming. Arthur suffered from premature ejaculation and I was a bedroom athlete. Arthur was unknown and I was powerful. Arthur was unappreciated and I was adored around the world and we were brothers. If the midget was uncertain about killing me for anyone else, Hoover reasoned, he might gladly kill me for himself.
But he didn't show, Mr. President,
Raymond says. But he did. He did not appear at the grassy knoll where they expected him. Being a Kennedy, he had brains to spare. He knew how the mob worked and the FBI, the CIA, the Cubans, the Russians, and the Birchers. He knew that someone would be there to gun him down, to silence him, after the deed was done. So the midget changed the plan on his own. Instead of going to the knoll, he slipped into the book depository. Slowly he climbed to the sixth floor, pausing at each staircase landing to catch his breath. He waddled on stubby legs to the corner room where he knew that Oswald was perched, rifle in hand. "New plan!" the midget barked. Oswald started to object. "Shut up and kneel down! If you miss, they'll kill you, but I won't miss." Lee Harvey Oswald was glad to oblige. He dropped to his knees. Arthur King climbed onto his back. "Now stand," he ordered. "In the shadow, near the window." Oswald did as he was told. Through the open window, they could see the motorcade emerging from the underpass, beginning to move slowly up the incline. The midget, perched like a monkey on Oswald's back, raised his rifle and took aim. Through his telescopic sight, my head appeared as large as a cantaloupe. Oswald raised his own mail-order rifle and took aim. With the crosshairs in place, Arthur King squeezed the trigger. A split second later, the bullet tore into my back. Lee Harvey Oswald fired and missed. On the grassy knoll, his snub-nosed pistol resting on the white fence, Jack Ruby fired and missed. From his perch on Oswald's back, the midget fired again. The bullet tore into my skull. It blew apart my brain. Fragments of flesh and bone and brain splintered across the car. landed in Jackie's lap, dropped like bits of garbage into the street. On the curb nearby, a 15-year-old boy was holding a movie camera. He kept it running as Jackie, half-crazed, not knowing what she was doing, climbed out onto the back of the car. A Secret Service man grabbed her hand, vaulted into the car, shoved her back in as the motorcade picked up speed and vanished away to Parkland Hospital.
I guess that explains it all,
Adlai says.
The cheap rifle that always seemed suspicious. The three shots in such rapid succession, too rapid for one man. The fourth shot on the dictabelt tape from the grassy knoll. And the puff of smoke that dozens of people saw there.
The Reverend nods his head thoughtfully.
That's why Hoover was so quick to announce that Oswald had acted alone, so the trail wouldn't lead back to the FBI or the CIA. Now, that's why they both withheld evidence from the Warren Commission.
And, Bobby says, because he knew the mob was involved, and the FBI would look awful if the mob had done it, since they should have uncovered the plot, and since Hoover was still insisting there was no mob.
It was obvious to me all along that it was some kind of conspiracy,
Lyndon says.
But I didn't want to find out. I didn't want it to lead to the Cubans or the Russians. If it did, then the American people would have needed revenge. And what the hell would we have done? Start World War III over Jack? It was better for everyone to leave it at that. That Oswald had acted alone. That's what I told Earl Warren, and he agreed.
The Reverend turns to Bobby.
And you? You and your whole family accepted in public, at least, that it was only Oswald. You never pressed for a real investigation. Why?
Because, Bobby says, if a probe led to the Mafia, the whole smutty relationship between Jack and Judy Campbell and Momo might come out, as well as the CIA hiring the mob to kill Castro. If the probe led to Cuba, the same things would come out. Jack's reputation would have been destroyed before his legend could grow.
The rest you know about, how the patsy, Oswald, making his getaway, shot and killed J.D. Salinger.
J.D. Tippit,
Lyndon corrects me. Same difference, Lyndon. Anyway, Oswald was captured soon after while trying to catch a flick and was taken to the Dallas jail where Jack Ruby moseyed in 2 days later with the connivance of the Dallas police and played You Bet Your Life on live TV. Oswald, the loser, of course.
And the real killer, Mr. President?
Raymond asks.
Whatever happened to King Arthur?
The midget dropped out of sight in the commotion and has never been heard from since. I felt little pain. The first shot produced a spasm of reflexive anger, as when a friend sneaking up on you from the rear startles you with a slap on the back. There was an instant of fear, as when lightning crashes close and you inexplicably dread the thunder. Then it came in a single big bang. All worlds colliding, a new one forming. Between the B in bang and the G in bang, I ejected. Like a fighter pilot whose F-16 is going down in the sea. I was no longer a participant, just one more spectator, before my blood spattered Jackie's stockings, before my brain left a trail in the gutter. So this is how it ends, I remember thinking. I had often wondered how it would end. Each man's life, yes, and woman's too, is a myth of his own creation. God writes only the endings. God deletes. They rushed me to the hospital. They rushed me into surgery. I followed along, a few feet above, watching with only mild interest. I was no longer my problem anymore. I was their problem. I was your problem. They set my time of death at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, November 22nd, 1963. A day like all days. Even as I was being lowered into a coffin, Lyndon was having himself sworn in aboard Air Force One, his baby now. Jackie standing beside him in the splattered pink. On the plane, she refused to change clothes. She would emerge looking the same in Washington. Let them see what they have done. Little suspecting who they was.
Having himself sworn in? Now, what's that supposed to mean?
That's what you did, isn't it?
What was I supposed to do? I was the goddamn VP.
You did just what you were supposed to do, Lyndon.
So why are you making an issue of it? As if I did something wrong. As if I did something suspicious. That's how all your buddies felt, I know. As if I had usurped the goddamn throne or something.
I'm not making an issue of it, Lyndon. I simply stated fact. You're making an issue of it. Why are you so touchy?
I'm not touchy, Lyndon snaps.
Then he adds woefully,
unlike Bobby, you were always kind to me, Jack. And it was me who invited you to Dallas. I suppose there's plenty of guilt to go around.
I turned away from Lyndon, the maudlin. I much preferred Lyndon the prick. Warts and all. Images followed, images burned as with a branding iron into the nation's consciousness. The riderless horse, Black Jack, with boots reversed in the stirrups. John, 3 years old that day, saluting his father's coffin. My wife, the bereaved widow, accepting the folded flag at Arlington. And the eternal flame, the flame that will burn forever, barring a shortage of propane. All of it stage managed brilliantly by Jackie, who had learned at my side the wondrous power of myth. Those of you who saw those images, who lived those images, will carry them with you to your own quiet graves. For the children, those too young then or those not born then, I am sorry. You are entering the American movie in the middle. You have missed America's greatest scene. Nothing to do now but eat your popcorn and try to enjoy the comedy. The date today, as I speak, is November 22nd. The year is 1988. The time is high noon. 25 years after the event. There is so much more to tell and so little time. Or, to put it another way, there is nothing at all to tell and endless time. You want a summing up? Some easy answers? You want to know what I have learned in my 25 years and the hereafter? I cannot say. To say would make me sound like Polonius. To thine own self be true, and I would rather die again than sound like Polonius. A few good laughs, a few good tears. That's all we can really ask of books or of life. It doesn't matter if you run countries or run tractors, spin thread or spin yarns, pull cotton or pull rank. It's all the same in the end. But there I go, philosophizing, doing what I didn't intend. I refuse. You have to find out for yourself in any case. Certain wisdom, however instructive, is not transferable. Most wisdom, in fact. Regrets? Do I have any regrets? Frankly, my dear, it's none of your fucking business. But obscenities do not become the hour. I shall say no more. 12:58 p.m., Central Standard Time. I turn. Martin and I embrace, without words. Raymond and I embrace. Adlai. Even Lyndon. And Bobby. Dear Bobby. What more is there to say? We embrace a second time. I wonder if we shall ever meet again. 12:59 p.m. We stand around awkwardly. I always hated goodbyes, I have an inspiration. I will get Lyndon and Bobby to embrace each other as one last favor to me. I do not do it. That will be up to them. They are no longer my concern. The light grows brighter. My friends grow dimmer. I reach out as if I want to hold back, as if I want to stay a while longer. My friends are fading. Or is it me that's fading? In the whiteness, I see a hand reaching out to me, waving. It's Raymond's hand. He wants to say something. He's not sure if I can hear him anymore. He winks and says it anyway.
Mr. President?
Yes, Raymond.
See you later, alligator.
The tolling of the bell grows louder. All is whiteness now. I no longer see the past. Only the future. I have a rendezvous.
I have a rendezvous with. Let us begin.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Robert Mayer's IJFK, performed by Bruce Watson and Paula Strongheart Garfield. And we thank you for listening.
There you have it, Seekers. The most fabulous piece of JFK Lee pull data that I could possibly pull out. IJFK by Robert Mayer. Oh, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. I fucking love you, Seekers. Good night.
Kill JFK. JFK.
It's none of your fucking business.